It's 12 o'clock. Welcome to the Torah session. Here we are, medieval Jewry, where they didn't play any baseball. And not that we know of anyways. Okay, but it's a pleasure to welcome everybody and Shuli back. I want to thank Lewis Katz for sponsoring this morning's shiur in memory of her mother, Sarah Beth Menachem Mendel. Then the Shama should have an aliyah. We should have happy occasions and long life. And of course, I do want to mention, of course, today's November 11th, Remembrance Day in Canada. I think in the States it's known as Veterans Day, but here it's known as Remembrance Day. And we have what to remember and to be thankful for the people who gave up their life. Of course, in Israel, we have no Yom HaZikaron, but the freedom of the Western world is due to the sacrifices made by so many. So we should just keep that in mind. And I guess our learning should be a schut for all of those who are no longer here. Okay.
Okay, thank you. What a beautiful introduction. Okay, hi, everybody. So I'm going to preface this class, and I'm going to probably give a very similar preface next week by saying that I am not a philosopher. Next week, I'm going to tell you that I am not a Kabbalist. I am neither of those things. So while we are going to talk about philosophy, because you can't really ignore it when you talk about the Rambam, don't expect me to give you too much Aristotle. The point here is that we are talking about history and the trends in history and what happened with the Rambam. But if you want to go deeper into the philosophy, I'm not your gal. So there are many, many wonderful classes and books that you can look into. But what we are going to look at today is something that really shook the Jewish world for a good century and a half and still has reverberations today. But it's something that we don't think about very much, and that's the Maimonidean controversy. Right? On the one hand, if you say to somebody the Rambam, Maimonides, they'll say, oh, one of the top 10 Jews of all time, one of the greatest scholars, everybody has the Rambam's books in their library. But if you were to go back to the time of the Rambam, or about 50 years after about 30 years after he passes away, some of his books are so controversial that they are banned. They are put into Chayre. And we have bans and counter bans, and how does this come about, and what's the story behind it, and what's the story behind the Rambam, who is a fascinating character in and of himself. So we're going to try to understand him and the Ramban and a few other people along the way in the larger context of his time. There are so many beautiful illustrated manuscripts of the Rambam, of the Mishnah Torah, also of the Moreh Nevuchim, that I couldn't resist bringing a few here and there. So this is one of them. If you ever go to the British Library in London, they have some gorgeous illuminated manuscripts of the Mishnah Torah. You can see there, but this is one of them. This is one of the earliest ones, actually. It's from the late 12th century, and it's just incredibly beautiful. So let's take a step back. Let's take a look at our timeline yet again, right? We keep looking back at this timeline, but it helps us to place the Rambam. 12th century, right, is a time period that is very on fire, let's say. The world is on fire, both in terms of the Crusades as well as what's happening in Spain, and that backdrop of so much going on between the Christians and the Muslims, between both of them and the Jews. That's one of the things that's going to push the Rambam to write what he writes. So just to understand a little bit of what we're talking about, right? Let's go back. 1099, right? The First Crusade, the First Crusade, which begins in 1096. 1099, the Crusaders come and take Jerusalem. The beginning of this 88-year enormous Crusader kingdom, right, which then falls apart in 1187 and then is reconstituted as something much smaller 4 years later. Okay? But the Crusaders have taken Jerusalem. The Rambam is born a few decades later. Okay, recent scholarship has put his birth date at 1138 instead of 1135, but not a huge difference. Okay, he's born in Spain, in Muslim Spain, but when he's still a young child, we have these very fanatical Muslims, the Almohad Muslims, which some people may remember from last week. We talked about Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi 40 years earlier. having to leave parts of Spain because they come into his part of Spain, right? So these are, the Rambam is born, like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in Muslim Spain, which is a relatively tolerant place, but this is a much more radical and fanatical form of Islam that forces conversion. And the Rambam's family, the Maimon family, a very distinguished family, are forced to flee. We don't know exactly what happens in the next 12 years or so. We do know that by 1160, the Maimonides family has resurfaced in Morocco, in Fez. We're going to see that. But then things become too hot for them as well, and they continue on, first with a short stop in the land of Israel, and then on to Egypt. Mute yourselves if you are not muted, please. And then on to Egypt, where the Rambam lives out the rest of his life. A very, very devastating event in the Rambam's life is when his brother, who he's A, very close to, and B, supports him, and he's a businessman, he drowns in the Indian Ocean. The date is a little bit approximate. We don't know exactly, but it's a huge crisis for the Rambam. And he begins to work. And he becomes a doctor to the royal house of the Sultan. And while he's doing this, and we're going to see what his daily schedule is like, right? Very, very famous letter that he writes about his schedule. He's able to write his enormous works of the Mishneh Torah, the Yad HaChazakah, and of the Guide to the Perplexed, the Moreh Nevuchim. And already, once he writes these books, there's already the first wave of this controversy. We'll talk about with who. Okay? Meanwhile, the Crusaders are defeated by Salah ad-Din, who is the Sultan, by the way, that Maimonides is the doctor for. Okay? 4 years later, the Third Crusade, Richard the Lionhearted, takes back parts of Israel. So you have this back and forth between the Christians and the Muslims. Meanwhile, just to bring in a character from last week who's going to come up again, the Ramban, right? Nachmanides is born towards the end of the Rambam's life. 10 years later, the Rambam dies in Egypt, is buried in Tveria. The second wave of the controversy is when the Ramban, right, Nachmanides, already has come to adulthood and is a very, very distinguished and important rabbi in Spain still. And he's going to be involved in the second wave of the controversy, which comes to a very shocking end when the Dominicans, right, in Provence, who are out for heresy, mostly Christian heresy, but they hear about Jewish heresy. Oh, why not? Let's take them along the way. There's a public burning of the Rambam's books, and this kind of shocks the Jewish world. And then the Talmud is burned as a result of the disputation of Paris in the 1240s, and Jews kind of take a step back from the brink and say, well, wait a second, maybe we shouldn't have all this internal conflict. Meanwhile, the Ramban comes to Israel, right, comes to Jerusalem, comes to Akko, the Crusader kingdom ends, and Jews being Jews, the controversy resurfaces again at the beginning of the 14th century. And towards the end of the class, we're going to talk about a very interesting character named Eshtori HaParchi, who is not really in the controversy itself, but he where he lives in the land of Israel is determined by the Maimonidean controversy. So that's just to give us the greater picture. We're going to come back to all of these things. Okay. So let's just start out with the Rambam's early life. Okay. He's born in Cordoba in Spain, and this is actually a very famous statue there, right? Jews are always very beloved after they have been kicked out of places. So there's a whole lot about the Rambam, about Maimonides in Cordoba, and there's this very famous statue of him there. But these radical Almohads come, and the Maimon family wanders through Spain. Eventually, they end up in Fez. This is the picture on the right here is the traditional house that's ascribed to the Maimon family in Fez. Does the family have to convert at some point, pretend to convert? There are people who say so. There are others who say not. But in any case, we do have two famous letters, one written by the Rambam's father, by Maimon, right, called Igeret HaNechama, the letter of condolence, and one written by the Rambam himself, Igeret HaShmad, the letter of forced conversion. And both of them are basically letters that are written to engage with Jews who have been forced to convert, to tell them that this is not the end and don't worry and you can always return, right? And we have unfortunately many time periods where such a letter has been written, right? Rashi also has to talk about, right? A Jew is always a Jew, no matter what. The Rambam actually writes his letter. This is one of the earlier letters that we have. We're going to come back to the letters of the Rambam a little later, but this is one of the earlier things that he writes. He's still a very young man. And he writes it in response to a rabbi who is not in Spain, who is not living under these very difficult conditions, and who writes condemning all Jews who convert to Islam under coercion, and how they're false Jews and how they've done this terrible thing and they should have all committed suicide. And the Rambam writes a response to this rabbi saying, you have no idea what these people have gone through and you don't understand the circumstances here. And basically he writes to the converts themselves that, first of all, you haven't lost your Judaism. And that's, you know, that's a zchut, but it's also a chova, right? It's something that don't think that because you have proclaimed your loyalty to Islam, that that's it. You're free from Judaism. You're never free from Judaism. And you have a responsibility to keep the mitzvot to the greatest extent that you can. And more importantly, you have a responsibility to get out and get to a place where you will be able to practice your Judaism. And this is the most famous part of the letter. And that's what we have written here. It behooves the victim, for the sake of his religion, to escape and flee to the desert and wilderness and not consider separation from family or loss of wealth, for they are a slight sacrifice and a paltry offering due to God, King of Kings, possessor of all things, the Lord your God, whose name is glorious and awful. God may be trusted to compensate you well in this world and in the world to come. We have noted that godly and pious folk who are animated by a desire to get acquainted with the truth and those who are engaged in its pursuit rush to the divine religion when their way from the most distant parts to the homes of scholars. They seek to gain increased insight into the law with the concomitant hope that God will amply reward them. How much more is it one's duty to go into the exile if the question of observing the whole Torah is at stake? So on the one hand, right, the Rambam is understanding of the circumstances. His own family has gone through these circumstances. He does not encourage suicide, although he says, if you die, al kiddush Hashem, that is obviously a great, you know, glorification of God's name. But unlike, for example, the rabbis and many of the teachers in the time of the Crusades in Ashkenaz, who really actively encouraged committing suicide, al kiddush Hashem, the Rambam doesn't go in that direction. However, he does say, don't be complacent, get out while you can. And that is exactly what the family does. They pick themselves up. 1165, they leave for the land of Israel. Remember, 1165, we're at the height of the first Crusader kingdom. The Crusaders control the coast, control Jerusalem, control basically the whole land. Right? They arrive in Akko. That's our picture up here, right, on the left. And the Rambam writes this beautiful letter where he writes about the travails of the journey and how they're saved from all this, you know, storms at sea. And he proclaims himself fast days to remember how God saved them. And then he writes very powerfully that after they've been in Akko for a little while, they continue on to Jerusalem and then on to Hebron. Right. And he writes, and it's actually fascinating because both these places are clearly controlled by the Crusaders. But he writes, on the first day of the week, the ninth day of the month of Mar Cheshvan, I left Jerusalem for Hebron. Right. I didn't bring you the part of the letter where he writes about going to Jerusalem to kiss the graves of my forefathers in the cave of Machpelah. On that very day, I stood in the cave and I praised God for everything. And these 2 days, and this is such a beautiful idea, and this is actually written up especially on a wall hanging in Marat HaMachpelah. These 2 days, the sixth, when he prayed on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and the ninth of Mar Cheshvan, I vowed to make as a special holiday, which I will rejoice with prayer, food, and drinks. Right? The idea is that you can make personal holidays for yourself, whether, you know, it's hodayah, thankfulness that you have been saved, or for other reasons. And he vows to make these days holidays for himself and his family. Fascinating question. does he really go up on the Temple Mount? Does he really go into Maran HaMachpelah? Do the Crusaders give him permission? And that's not something that we really have an answer for. So it's very interesting. Maybe one day we'll find out. But at the moment, we do not know. Right? But he doesn't stay on in the land of Israel. He continues on to Egypt. And the question of whether the Rambam sees Yishuv Eretz Israel as a mitzvah, right? Is it a commandment to live in the land of Israel? We talked about this a little bit last time, that Nachmanides definitely sees it as a commandment. Does the Rambam see it as a commandment? Probably, but he doesn't write it in his list of mitzvot. But in any case, he continues on to Egypt, and he continues on to Fostat, which is the old city of Cairo. He becomes involved in the polemics and the battles with the Karaites, right? And he holds a very interesting position. On the one hand, he recognizes the Karaites as part of the Jewish communities, as we have to give them services like circumcision, like burying them in Jewish cemeteries, right? We have to do chesed for them. We have to give them charity, but they're not counted in a minyan. We have to speak out against the way they observe the commandments. So he kind of walks this middle line, but he's fighting against the Karaites, who, as we may recall, are very powerful at this point, especially in Egypt. Now he's involved in his time studying and writing and doing the things that he does, because he's able to do that because he's being supported by his brother, right? He has this, what we often call Yisachar Zvulun relationship, right? Where one is the businessman and the other one is the Torah scholar, and each one shares in the rewards, the material rewards and the spiritual rewards of what is happening. But then we have this very devastating news that he receives, and we don't know exactly when it happens, but at some point in the probably the late 1160s, the early 1170s, his brother is on a business trip in the Indian Ocean. His ship is caught in a storm and he is drowned, leaving behind his own family and, of course, the Rambam's family. And the Rambam is devastated. We actually have a letter in the Cairo Geniza that was discovered not so long ago talking about how this was the single most devastating moment of his life. Obviously because he's lost his brother, but also because now he has to figure out his direction, because the Rambam is adamant, and he writes it in a number of places in his books. He is adamant that a Torah scholar does not receive payment for being a Torah scholar. Okay? You do your Torah as something that is, you know, a way to serve God, but you work at a profession and you make your money not through the study of Torah, the teaching of Torah. So he has to make a living. Okay. So he had studied medicine already in Morocco, already in North Africa. He studies medicine and he becomes a doctor. And actually we know that the Rambam is a very, very competent doctor, not only because of the positions he gets, but because he writes medical treatises and he writes about what are healthy ways to live and what are ways to, you know, and obviously we're talking about medieval medicine, but he writes a lot of very good advice, but about balancing, right? Balancing your humors and all these different things that today he would have definitely been in the top, you know, in Rambam Hospital in Haifa, but he's very cutting edge for his time. In fact, you can actually create recipes that he wrote, right? He writes about a drink that's meant to cleanse you, a Rambam drink. You can actually buy it in the Shuk in Jerusalem. Okay. And he becomes a very famous and important doctor. And of course, he is most famous for tending to the Sultan's family. He starts out as a doctor for the vizier, for the second to the Sultan, Al-Fadil. He eventually becomes the doctor for the Sultan's family. And like we said, Saladin, right? He becomes the doctor for Saladin's family. And that's this guy in the middle. There is a widespread legend, which has really never been proved by anybody, that what either Richard the Lionhearted or another crusader ruler tries to kind of lure him away from Saladin and bring him to serve the crusaders, and he refuses. Is this true? Is this not true? Nobody really knows. Right? But he makes his living as a doctor. And he is also the leader of the Jewish community, and his life is very, very busy. One of the most famous things that the Rambam wrote, right, not necessarily because it's so important in terms of Torah, but because it's fascinating, is this letter, right? Some people may remember the old Beit HaTfutzot, the old diaspora museum in Tel Aviv. Today it's been completely redone, but they had a big display about this letter because it's a very interesting look into the everyday life of somebody who was so incredibly busy and achieved so much. So what's the backdrop to this letter? The Ibn Tibbon family. These are a family of Jews, very, very intellectual, intelligent Jews in Provence. And they are famous for being doctors, and they are more famous for being translators. They translate from Arabic to Hebrew. The father is Yehuda Ibn Tibbon. The son is Shmuel Ibn Tibbon. The family originally comes from Spain, lives in Provence. They are very well known in terms of their translations. We actually have a fascinating ethical will of Yehuda Ibn Tibbon. It's very famous because he writes it to his sons and what you should do and how you should study and how you should take care of yourself. But the famous part is he writes, take very good care of your books because your books are your best friends and your best treasure, right? And he writes about, cleaning your books and not, lending them out, but making sure you get them back, right? It's very interesting. But the son, Shmuel Ibn Tibbon, wants to translate. Most of the Rambam's works, as we're going to see, were written in Arabic. And he wants to translate the Guide to the Perplexed, but he says, it would be so much better if I were to come and to meet you and to speak with you, right? Even though the journey will be arduous, but it's definitely better than these letters, right? We're not talking about emails. It takes a very long time for a letter to get anywhere. So could I come and visit you? He writes to the Rambam, and the Rambam writes back to him, as much as I would love for you to visit me, and I want to communicate with you, and I want to have this connection, this is what my day looks like, right? And he says, I live in Fostat and the Sultan lives in Cairo. The distance between them is 4,000 cubits, a mile and a half. My duties to the Sultan are very heavy. I must see him every morning to check on his health. If one day he doesn't feel well, or one of the princes or the women of his harem doesn't feel well, I cannot leave Cairo that day. It often happens that there is an officer or two who needs me and I have to attend to healing them all day. Thus, I am in Cairo each day. And even if nothing unusual happens, by the time I come back to Fostat, half the day has passed. Under no circumstances do I come earlier, and I am ravenously hungry by then, right? He eats once a day. When I come home, my foyer is always full of people, Jews and non-Jews, important people and not, judges and policemen, people who love me, people who hate me, a mixture of people, all of whom have been waiting for me to come home, right? Many of them want to see him as a doctor, by the way. He's not only a doctor to the Sultan, he's a doctor to the common people. Plus, he's a community leader, so many people need to see him. I get off my donkey, wash my hands, go into the hall to see them. I apologize and ask that they should give me a few minutes to eat. This is the only meal I take in 24 hours. Then I go out to heal them and give them prescriptions and instructions for treating their problems. Patients come and go till nightfall, and sometimes, I swear to you by the Torah, it is 2 hours into the night before they are all gone. I talk to them and prescribe for them, even while lying on my back from exhaustion. And when the night comes, I am so weak, I cannot even talk anymore. Because of all this, no Jew can come and see and speak with me in wisdom or have a private audience with me because I have no time except on Shabbat. On Shabbat, the whole congregation, or at least the majority of it, comes to me after morning services, and I instruct the members of the community as to what they should do during the entire week. We learn together in a week fashion till the afternoon, then they go home. Some of them come back, and I teach them more deeply between the afternoon and evening prayers. That is my daily schedule, and I have only told you a little of what you would see if you would come. So basically, bottom line, don't come. Okay. In this schedule, somehow he finds the time to write two of the greatest works in Jewish literature, the Mishneh Torah and the Morah Nevuchim. The commentary to the Mishnah, which is also a very famous and important work of the Rambam, he writes already in his youth while he's in Morocco. But the Mishneh Torah and the Morah Nevuchim are mostly written while he is going through this insane schedule. Okay? So let's talk a little about these two very important books, right? And the illustrations here, the pictures here are, again, illuminated manuscripts. Here on the left, this is of the Sefer HaAvodah from the Mishneh Torah, and the one on the right is of the Morah Nevuchim, where the guy holding the globe or the astrolabe or whatever is he's holding here, right? This is supposed to be Aristotle, okay? Did Aristotle look like that? I don't know. Okay. And in the middle, of course, is the signature of the Rambam. We actually have, because of the Cairo Geniza and because of various other places, we actually have quite a few manuscripts written by the Rambam in his own hand, which is actually very thrilling. The Israel Museum did an exhibit about his the manuscripts that we have of his a few years ago. And it's just, there's something about seeing, right? Seeing the hand. It's a cool thing. So what are these books? Okay. So the Mishnah Torah, which is also known as the Yad HaChazakah, the Rambam calls it the Mishnah Torah, the second Torah. And we're going to see the introduction that he writes, why he calls it that. But there were Jews who did not like that name so much. Who are you to call your book the second Torah? Right. And so they gave it a different name, the Yad HaChazakah, the great hand, but Yad stands for Yudalid 14, because there are 14 books, of the Mishnah Torah. And the idea is that it is a book. It's the book that he writes in Hebrew, in Mishnaic Hebrew, actually in beautiful, clear Hebrew. And it is a systematic work of halakha in 14 books, basically taking the idea of the Mishnah, but making it much more organized, and we'll come back to it in a minute. Okay. The Mara Nevuchim is a very different kind of book, the Guide to the Perplexed, written in Arabic, translated into Hebrew already in Rambam's lifetime, but many times since. The most recent and probably what's considered the best translation is Rav Yosef Kapach, Alav HaShalom, a Yemenite Jew who translated into Hebrew, I don't know, 50 years or so ago. And this is a book that is written to help Jews to deal with the challenges of faith versus reason, Aristotelian philosophy versus the Torah. And that's going to be the crux upon which this controversy is going to be centered. We're going to come back to that. Okay. But first, let's talk a little about the Mishnah Torah. And even before that, some of the letters. Okay, the Rambam writes many letters. He gets many queries, some of them halachic, some of them philosophical, right? Many different people and communities that he has to answer. Some of these letters are very famous. And one of the things that's very beautiful about these letters is you get a different picture of the Rambam. If you just read the Mishnah Torah, and certainly if you read the Guide to the Perplexed, you get a sense of someone who is brilliant, who is very intellectual, who does not suffer fools gladly. But when you read the letters, you see kind of a softer side, and someone who has a deep and abiding love for the Jewish people, and wants to defend them and to protect them. So one of the letters he writes is a very powerful letter. That's the one here you have on the left. It's a letter that he writes to someone who's called Ovadia Hager, Ovadia the proselyte. There's actually a different Ovadia Hager who lives a little bit after the time of the Rambam, who's famous as a musician. He's Italian. It's not this guy, probably, because the timing doesn't work. But Ovadia is a good name for a ger, right? Oved Hashem, a servant of God. And Ovadia writes a letter to the Rambam asking him what seems to be a, you know, kind of an innocent halachic question, but there's a lot of feeling hidden behind it, which is, when I pray, do I say our God and God of our fathers, Elokeinu ve'Elokei Avoteinu? Because it's not my avot, it's not my fathers, right? He is a ger, he's a proselyte. And if we think back to last week, to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who talks about the uniqueness and the chosenness of the Jewish people, that you can join the Jewish people, but there is something, he didn't use this word, but there's something almost genetic about the uniqueness of the Jewish people. And here the Rambam is going to say something very different, right? And he says to him, first of all, to answer your question, you should pray our God and God of our fathers, because Abraham, peace be with him, is your father, right? The father of all the Gerim are Abraham and Sarah. There is no difference whatever between you and us. You shall certainly say the blessing, who has chosen us, who has given us, who have taken us, right? All these things, atar b'chartanu, atanatata, right? It's to you as well as to all other Jews. For the Creator has indeed chosen you and separated you from the nations and given you the Torah. For the Torah has been given to us and to the proselytes, as it says, one ordinance shall be for both of you, for the congregation, and also for the stranger that sojourns with you. know that our fathers, when they came out of Egypt, were mostly idolaters. They had mingled with the pagans in Egypt and imitated their way of life until the Holy One, may he be blessed, sent Moses, our teacher, who separated us from the nations and brought us under the wings of the divine presence, us and all proselytes, and gave to all of us one law. Do not consider your origin as inferior. While we are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you derive from him through whom his word, the world was created. Right? It's a beautiful, beautiful letter. And the other letter that I brought here is the Igeret Teiman, the letter to the Yemenite community. And it's a letter from 1173, when the Yemenite community, which had undergone up until they left in, you know, in the 1940s, many, many persecutions, was a very downtrodden, very faithful, but very downtrodden community. And this is a letter that he writes in response to someone from the community who writes him a letter telling him about the troubles that have happened to the Ammonite Jews, and also telling him about a false Messiah, right? And what should we do about this false Messiah? And basically, he writes back this letter, first of all, saying, you know, giving them hope in the light of all this persecution, and don't worry, and God is going to help you. And second, saying, don't be tempted by Christianity or Islam. They are very pale imitations of Judaism. And finally, he addresses this issue of the false Messiah. And we're going to come back to the ultimate false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, in the last class that we do here. But a false Messiah is something that has come up throughout Jewish history. And the Rambam wants to deal with it. And one of the strong arguments that he gives, and he talks about this in his halachic works, is a Messiah, and even not a Messiah, but just a prophet, has to be somebody who is very intellectually competent. He has to know things. He has to understand things. He has to know a lot of Torah. And here is this person who's a nobody. Of course he's not the Messiah, right? You mentioned that a certain man in one of the cities of Yemen pretends that he is the Messiah. As I live, I am not surprised at him or at his followers, for I have no doubt that he is mad. And a sick person should not be rebuked or reproved for an illness brought on by no fault of his own. Neither am I surprised at his votaries, for they were persuaded by him because of their sorry plight, right? False Messiahs come at times of great trouble in Jewish history, and that's why people are tempted by him. Their ignorance of the importance and high rank of the Messiah and their mistaken comparison of the Messiah with the son of the Mahdi, whose rise they are witnessing. But I am astonished that you, a scholar who has studied carefully the doctrines of the rabbis, are inclined to repose faith in him. Do you not know, my brother, that the Messiah is a very eminent prophet, more illustrious than all the prophets after Moses? Do you not know a false pretender to prophecy is liable to capital punishment? But what better evidence is there of his mendacity than his very pretensions to be the Messiah? How odd is your remark about this man, that he is renowned for his meekness and a little wisdom? As if these were indeed the attributes of the Messiah, did these characteristics make him a Messiah? You are beguiled by him because you have not considered the preeminence of the Messiah, the manner and place of his appearance, and the marks whereby he is to be identified. The fact that this man is a nobody should already tell you that this is not the Messiah. Now, the Jews of Yemen felt a huge debt to the Rambam for this letter, for what he wrote. They very closely identified with his writings and connected to them. And in fact, the Ramban, Nachmanides, writes in the letter that we're going to read in a little bit, in defense of the Rambam during the Maimonidean controversy, he writes that the Yemenite Jews held the Rambam in such regard that they actually included him in the Kaddish, right? When they say b'chayechon, they also say u'b'chaye Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, right? In the life of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, of Maimonides, which we don't know how long this custom continued, probably not after the Rambam died, but it's an extraordinary thing that they inserted him into the Kaddish, which is pretty wild. And there's definitely a connection between Yemenite Jews going all the way to the 20th century and Rav Kapach, who writes his own commentary, his own translation of the Guide to the Perplexed. But let's get into this question of the Mishnah Torah, right? The Rambam writes a long introduction to his book where he explains, first of all, the Masorah, right? He explains the passage of the oral law from Moshe down through the generations. And he talks about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who after everything has been passed down orally, decides to compile the Mishnah. Why? Because of the troubles of the times. And because things are so troubled, he feels that Torah might be forgotten, and therefore we need to have everything written down. And the Rambam looks at himself and at his time, right? And he's lived through the persecutions by the Muslims, and he's lived through the troubles of the Crusaders. And he looks around and he says, in this age, as you can see here, right? Let's read inside. With afflictions mightily intensified, the pressure of the hour weighing heavily upon everybody, when the wisdom of our wise did perish and the prudence of our prudent was hid, all commentaries, treatises, and response of which the Gonim compiled and considered by them as clear texts are perplexities in our day. And only a select few comprehend the subject matter thereof, not to speak of the Talmud itself, both the Babylonian and the Jerusalem, the Sifra, Sifrei, and Tosefta, which require a broad understanding, a soul endowed with wisdom, and lengthy reflection where one may find the right path therein to ascertain the things which are forbidden and the things which are permitted, or to fathom the how and why of the law of the Torah, other laws of the Torah. So he says, we are living in a time similar to Rebbe, where there are a lot of troubles, and it requires a lot of time and intelligence and training to understand the Gemara and to understand the Geonim, and people don't have those resources. And therefore, we need to have it clearly set out for us as a code. Therefore have I, Moses, son of Maimon of Spain, right? He always writes in, signs his name that he's Spanish, Sfaradi Tahor, or Hasfaradi, right? It's very important to him, his lineage, girded up my loins and supporting myself upon the rock, blessed be he, made a comprehensive study of all those books and minded myself to construct out of all of these compilations a clear summary on the subject of that which is forbidden or permitted, defiled or clean, along with the other laws the Torah, the whole scope in pure language and concise style, so that the oral Torah be entirely methodical in the mouth of everybody, without query, without repartee, without the contemptuous thus of one and such of another, right? Anyone who's learned any Gemara at all, even one page, knows exactly what he's talking about. I don't need all the back and forth, all the havayot abaye varaba. I don't need to know this and that and a story along the way and a recipe and a No, I just need to know the law. Clear text, cohesive, correct, in harmony with the law, which is defined out of all of these existing compilations and commentaries from the days of our holy master till now, so that all laws be open to young and old, whether they be laws concerning each and every commandment or concerning matters instituted by the scholars and the prophets. And here's where he really gets himself in trouble. The main object of the matter being, no man shall have a need of any other compilation in the world for any law of the laws of Israel, but this compilation shall be an encyclopedia of the whole oral Torah, together with a code of the statutes, customs, and edicts, which were enacted since the days of Moses, until the close of the Talmud, as they were interpreted us by the Gaonim. Therefore, I have named this compilation Mishnah Torah, for when studies Holy Writ first, and thereafter reads this work, he obtains a complete knowledge of the oral Torah, having no need to read any other book in between them. Oy, oy, Rambam, you've gone a step too far. That's it. All you need is the Torah and the Mishnah Torah. You can understand why people got angry about that. Now, what are the pros and cons of this work? If anybody has learned Gemara or Mishnah and has learned the Mishnah Torah, the pros are obvious. First of all, it's a beautiful book. The Rambam's mind was so logical and worked in such an incredible way. When you learn Gemara, Gemara is a wonderful thing, but it tends to not necessarily be the most systematic, okay? And you can start with, the first chapter of the Mishnah will be in the middle of the story. The Rambam is beautiful. He goes in order. He explains it all. He lays out the principles. Everything is written in a beautiful Mishnaic Hebrew. It has a beginning. It has a middle. It has an end. He is the father of the codes, okay? That's the pros. Those are pretty big pros. Hey, the cons, first of all, people did not like this hubris. This is all that you need. And second, also he includes some Greek philosophy, particularly in Sefer Hamada and the Book of Knowledge in the beginning. And finally, and the greatest argument against it, is set out most concisely and most perfectly by the Ravid, right? Rabbi Avram ben David of Posquer. This is a beautiful picture of Provence. It has nothing to do with the Ravid except that he lived in Provence. I have no pictures of the Ravid, but his nickname is Baal HaHasagot, the master of critical annotations. And he is the first one to really go through the Mishnah Torah and write where he often vehemently disagrees with the Rambam. He doesn't disqualify the book. He doesn't say the book is not important, but he writes where he disagrees. And he has a vehement disagreement about this method of the Rambam where he writes the laws without writing opinions. He just writes the bottom line. Okay. And listen to what he said. He intended to improve, but did not improve, for he forsook the way of all authors who preceded him. They always adduced proof for their statements and cited the proper authority for each statement. This was very useful, for sometimes the judge would be inclined to forbid or permit something, and his proof was based on some other authority. Had he known there was a greater authority who interpreted the law differently, he might have retracted. Now, therefore, I do not know why I should reverse my tradition or my views because of the compendium of this author. Why should I rely upon his choice when it is not acceptable to me? Okay, the Ravid is laying out the problem of all subsequent halachic decisors, of all poskim. How can I make a decision when I only have the bottom line? I need to know, is there a minority opinion? What are the proofs for the opinion, right? He's basically, the Rambam is doing away with psak. He's doing away with the ability of any later rabbi to come up with an opinion that's different. And this is ultimately why the Mishnah Torah becomes completely accepted in the Jewish world, and yet the purpose of the book is completely subverted, because tens, probably more, right? Dozens of people write books that are called the Nosei Kelim. They write books about the Mishnah Torah, where they bring down every source that the Rambam took pains to admit. It's exactly the opposite of what the Rambam wanted to happen, right? But today, the Mishnah Torah today, for centuries, the Mishnah Torah has been used as a way to learn Gemara and as a way to look at all the different opinions and sources and thoughts, which is not at all what the Rambam intended, but is what is useful and helpful for poskim. Okay, and it's a fascinating thing that the Ravid really, I think, says in the most clear way possible. He also does not like that the Rambam tells you not just how to decide halakha, but what to think, right? The dogmas, one of the most famous things of the Rambam is his Yud Gimel Ikarim, his 13 principles. These are the things that everybody has, all Jews have to believe. And the Ravid says, you know what? Maybe not all Jews have to believe that, right? And this is obviously something, there are books that have been written about this. We're just going to mention it for a moment. But particularly when he talks about beliefs, the Ravid steps in and says, you know what, I might agree with you, but don't forget that there are other people who disagree with you. So two very famous examples, right? Both of them from Ilchot Tshuva, where the Rambam talks not only about the laws of repentance, but also about such things as the world to come. Okay? The world to come harbors neither body nor aught of a concrete form, save only the souls of the righteous divested of body, as are the ministering angels, right? This becomes a very controversial statement. Later in his life, the Rambam has to write a letter called Igeret Chiyat HaMeitim, right? The letter about resurrection. What do you mean that there's only resurrection of the soul and not the body, right? Inasmuch as it harbors no concrete forms, there is no need for eating, drinking, or other of the bodily necessities of the sons of man in this world. Neither will any of the many things which happen to bodies in this world come to pass there, as for instance, sitting down, standing up, sleep, death, sadness, mirth, or the like. It's not that there are no sources to support what the Rambam says. Of course there are sources, but there are also sources in the other direction. And that's what the Ravid is coming to say, right? Here's the Hasagot arrive at on the bottom. The world to come harbors neither body nor out of concrete form. This man's words are in my eyes near to such who assert there is no resurrection to body but the soul alone. But by the life of my head, this was not the opinion of our sages. May their memory be blessed. Okay? And many others agree with the Ravid that how can you say such a thing? And another very interesting one, right, where the Rambam, he's going to write about this in the Mara Nevuchim as well, right? Very important to him to attest very clearly that God is incorporeal. God does not have a body. God does not have a form, not in any way. And he says there are five categories of minim, of atheists. He who says there is no God and no omnipotence. He who says there is an omnipotence, but there are two or more. He who says there is one Lord, but that he is corporeal and has a form. And the Rabbit says, why does he call such one an atheist? Many greater and better than he followed this opinion, according to what they saw in phrases, and more particularly in the text of the Agadot, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean the Rabbit agreed that God has a body and a form, but he says, you know what? Don't disqualify all the Jews who think this way. Okay? Dogmas are a dangerous thing. And this brings us to the story of the Maimonidean controversy. Okay, so I think it's an old text, but I think it's very well written. Professor Chaim Hillel Ben Sasson, in his article on the Maimonidean controversy in the Encyclopedia Judaica, this is how he sums it up: a vast complex of disputed cultural, religious, and social problems, focusing around several central themes. Some antedate Maimonides, and some have remained topical. I.e., this is a question that is rooted in much, much earlier issues. It continues on really till today, but it also is rooted in its time and place. Okay? So probably the earliest version of this question of, do we accept Greek wisdom? Because what is the Rambam doing, right? When he writes the Guide to the Perplexed, he's writing it because there are people who will believe in Aristotelian philosophy. This is a bust of Aristotle, who's considered to be the greatest of the philosophers, certainly in the Middle Ages. And Jews are studying it and saying, but wait, this doesn't jive with what I know about Torah, right? Most famously, that Aristotle says the world is eternal, not created. And the Rambam writes the Mora Nevuchim in order to guide these people and help these people. But this question of how much do we listen to the Greeks and Greek wisdom, or rather, how much do we listen to wisdom that is not Torah wisdom? It already appears in the time of the Gemara. It certainly continues throughout medieval times. It reappears in the time of the Haskalah, of the Enlightenment, and it's still an issue today. So this is a very large question that kind of really burns up the Jewish world in the 12th and 13th century, but it's important before and after. So I'll just bring you one Gemara, right? Famous Gemara and the end of Masechet Sotah. Right, it talks about various decrees that the rabbis made because of certain troubles that happened in the War of Titus, i.e. the Great Revolt where the temple is destroyed. They decreed upon the crowns of brides, right, that the bride can't go out wearing a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, this beautiful diadem. And they decreed that a person should not teach his son Greek. And then the Gemara goes back and forth. Does it mean Greek language? Does it mean Greek wisdom? Right? Which is it? And is Greek wisdom prohibited? But didn't Rabbi Yehuda say that Shmuel said in the name of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, what is it written? What is the meaning of that which is written, my eye affects my soul, right? A pasuk from Echa. There were 1,000 children in my father's house, the prince's household, right? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is the son of Rabban Gamliel. 500 of them learned Torah, and the other 500 learned Greek wisdom. And the Gemara says, so is it really prohibited? The members of the house of Gamliel are different, as they were close to monarchy. So already in the time of the Gemara, we're talking about, should you be learning outside languages, outside wisdom, philosophy, all kinds of things like that? Is it for everybody? Is it only for certain people? What is the purpose of it, right? This is an ongoing debate. In the Rambam's time, the debate metamorphoses as a debate between those who see themselves as rationalists and philosophers and those who take a more mystical view of the world. So what exactly is happening? The epicenter of this whole issue is in partly in Spain, mostly in Provence, with some intervention. So here we have Provence, right, over here, with some intervention from the rabbis of northern France, right, the Baalei HaTosfot, and of course from the Rambam, right, over here. We have three major waves of this controversy. One already during the lifetime of the Rambam, and that's what we're talking about with the Ravid and the arguments over whether the Mishnah Torah should be accepted as it is. What do we think about the Guide to the Perplexed? Right, that's during the lifetime of the Rambam in the 1180s. Then things kind of quiet down and flare up again about 25 years after the Rambam dies, 1230s. That's when we have this the center of the controversy being in Provence, where we have Provençal rabbis who are both for and against the Rambam. You have very famous Rabbi Shlomo Min Hahar, Rabbi Shlomo of Montpellier, who is against the Rambam, against the teaching of Greek philosophy, and you have rabbis who are against him. Right. And that's where we're going to see that the Ramban, Nachmanides, steps in to write a letter. There's a ban on learning the Guide to the Perplexed, on learning Sefer Hamada of the Mishnah Torah. And all of this kind of comes to this shocking end with the burning of the Rambam's books by the Dominicans. The third wave is also in Provence, right, and in other parts of France, where you have a ban, not necessarily on the Rambam. The Rambam himself is very accepted by this point, but a ban on learning any Greek literature under the age of 25, a counter ban by the Meiri, who says, no, 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 this is very important to learn, right? Basically what's going on here is a difference between the ways of Ashkenaz and the ways of Provence and Spain, right? The educational world that is much more closed, much more Torah-based, and the educational world that's much more involved in the larger culture, and which one is right, right? The main questions, the main points are what is proper for a Torah scholar to study, philosophy and reason versus faith and tradition. Can we have any kind of anthropomorphisms about God? Or are all of these things allegories? And this question of resurrection, right? And like I said, this continues to reverberate throughout Jewish history in different forms, but we're going to focus on a few of the major battles. So like we said, 1230s, battles in Provence, and Nachmanides, who we're going to see is much more of on the mystical side, right, and not the rational side, is called upon to write a letter to the rabbis of northern France to support Rabbi Shlomo Min Hahar against the Rambam. But instead, Nachmanides goes in a very different direction, and he writes a magnificent, beautiful letter where, first of all, he completely defends the Rambam and talks about him as one of the greatest scholars of all time. And he also talks about the necessity to unite the Jewish people and not to divide them. He cites the Ravid, and he says as much as the Ravid disagreed with the Rambam, he never suggested putting him into Cherem, right? And then he writes something very interesting, and he says the Rambam did not write his works about philosophy for you, rabbis of northern France, but for those who are steeped in this philosophy and in the secular culture, and he wants to help them, right? And this is probably the most famous part of the letter. The entire country of France, its rabbis and princes, all of them have agreed to ban and excommunicate every man who will lift up his hand to meditate in the book of Noren Nevuchim and the Sefer Amada. This is the essential formula of your words, condensed to a little from much, a spark from a great fire which shall not be quenched. You have not shown honor to the great rabbi. He raised up the desolate house of our Talmud. How many dispersed of faith has he gathered? How many hungry for wisdom is his bread given, his water sure? How many atheists who have put our Talmud to shame has he answered correctly? If you in France are in the bosom of faith, soundly planted in the courtyard of tradition, will you not pay heed to those that dwell in the outermost parts? Meaning you're in your little bubble of Torah. Look outside. The Rambam is dealing with those people who are being led astray. Was it for you, majesties of the Talmud, that Maimonides wearied himself? Have you heard their words, the words of the philosophers? Have you gone astray by their proofs? Right? And he continues. He says, the rabbi has made his books as a shield against punishment to raise up those who are drowning. It's truly a magnificent letter. It is very worth reading in the original Hebrew if you can. But basically, he calls for unity. He calls for restraint. He says, you want to ban teaching the Moreh Nevuchim in public, that's okay, but don't ban it in private. There are people who need it. ultimately, as we said, the Dominicans, and this is the picture here, this is the one of the symbols of the Dominicans, the Dominicani, the hounds of the Lord, horrible, horrible people who fought against heresy, mostly Christian heresy, but here Jewish heresy as well. And they burn the books of the Rambam. And this is something that is very shocking to the Jews and pushes them to kind of step back a little from the brink. But let's take a look in the last few minutes that we have. We won't read through all of this. I think I oversourced as usual, but you have it to read at home. But just to understand a little bit of the differences of what we're talking about when we talk about rationalists versus mystics. And the clearest way to understand that, I think, is to look at the difference between the Rambam and his younger, not really contemporary, the Ramban, right? Nachmanides. The Rambam says, look at the Torah. The Torah is all about teaching you or improving you in some way, right? In this chapter of the Guides to the Perplexed, he writes about how there are reasons for every commandment. He says some people find it difficult that there are reasons, and they assume that this is coming from God and it's divinely mandated, right? And he says, God wouldn't do things without reasons. Of course, there are reasons, and there are reasons for everything, and they are meant to make us better people, right? They are meant to make us have better opinions and better morals and better conduct, and that is the purpose of the Torah. And then he goes on and he talks about one, this is probably one of the more famous reasons he gives for commandments, the commandment of sacrifices. And he says, why do we give sacrifices? Because in ancient times, pagans gave sacrifices, and Jews wanted to follow in this way of giving sacrifices, and God couldn't just say, forget that, I don't need this, just worship me as in prayer. No, because this is what they're used to, and this is what the world does. So God takes this idea and turns it towards him. And this is a classic Maimonidean way of looking at mitzvot, that God is trying to teach us the right, the proper ways of behavior, taking what we're used to, putting it in a right direction. And along comes the Ramban, and he says, yes, that may all be true, but there's so much more, right? The Torah is so much more than just teaching us. It's not just a manual of behavior. And this is where we get into the mystical ideas, and the Ramban has a very mystical and Kabbalistic approach to the Torah. So, for example, in the introduction to his commentary, he writes that there's a tradition that the whole Torah, if you divide it up differently, is the names of God, right? Some of you may be familiar with Torah codes. This is kind of a little bit of a, the Torah code is a little bit of a perversion of this idea. But there is inherent divinity and significance to the Torah, to the words of the Torah itself. And it's the meaning of creation, and it's the meaning of the world. And it's so much more than just making us better people. Not that that's not important. And then he, in the beginning of Vayikra, he goes, lays into the Rambam about sacrifices. And he says, what are you talking about? You really think that the way to train people away from their pagan ways is to have them sacrifice to God instead of to idols? They worshiped animals. Why would you not say, you know, stop this completely? You would say, don't, the animals are abominable. Besides that, he says, long before there are pagans, right? Adam sacrifices, Noah sacrifices. So he says, this is clearly not the reason. And he gives a very kind of shot, right? A simple explanation. And then he says there's also mysteries as well. But the pshat explanation is a very powerful one. And he says, when you give a sacrifice, you are killing an animal, and you need to see yourself in that animal. Really, by my bad behavior, this should be me, right? There, but for the grace of God, go I. And I should be the one who's being sacrificed. And this is a way to take my blood instead of, take the animal's blood instead of my blood, and it's going to help you to atone. And then he says, in the context of mysticism, the sacrifices contain hidden mysteries. Okay, we're not going to go into the Kabbalistic ideas, maybe a little next week, but the Ramban says this rational view of the world might be very acceptable and very powerful and very beautiful, but there's much more going on. You can take whichever approach you like. Most Jews tend to be split into camps of the rationalists versus the mystics. Could take a little of each, whichever you like better. But we're going to finish up with Eshtori HaParchi. Eshtori HaParchi Eshtori, Ish Tours. He's the man from Tours. Okay. He comes from France, and he is, kicked out with the expulsions from, of the Jews from France, in, the early 1300s. Eventually, after traveling around, he makes his way to the land of Israel. He writes in his introduction to his book that I'm going to talk about in a second, that he, tries to go to Jerusalem and to live in Jerusalem, but there is so much trouble because of these controversies that he instead picks himself up and he goes to live in Beit Sham, which he sees as the opening to Gan Eden. So this is our very tenuous connection to the Maimonidean controversy. But Eshtori HaParchi is a fascinating guy because he's really one of the first people to look at the land of Israel in a way that today is very common, right? Trying to understand the land and the topography and to figure out where the towns are in Tanakh and not to just rely on hearsay or traditions, but actually to travel in the land and to figure out where things are. And he writes a book called Katora Perach, which hundreds of years before archaeologists come up with this idea, he already is explaining that when there is an Arab name that sounds a lot like the Tanakh name of a town, like Bitin, which sounds like Beit El, then you should assume that this is where the biblical town is. This is a principle that archaeologists use in the 19th century. Eshtori HaParchi came up with it in the 14th century. He lives in Beit She'an, which was ruined by his time, but was still a place that he really liked. And finally, just to finish up the Rambam, like we said, the Rambam dies in Egypt, but he is brought and buried in the land of Israel. We have very early testimony already from his grandson about his grave in Tveria and Tiberias. So unlike a lot of other graves, which are very speculative, the grave of the Rambam in Tiberias is pretty much a known fact, is a sure thing. Why Tiberias? Good question. Tiberias is really the home of the Masorah, as we saw in one of the first classes here. So the Rambam is the father, the carrier on of the Masorah. It makes sense that he should be in Tiberias. And of course, on his tomb, Mi Moshe ad Moshe, Lo Kam Ki Moshe, right? From Moses to Moses, there is no one like Moses. And he has a lasting legacy, both in scholarship and in Torah, right? On halachic study, on Gemara study, philosophy, rational, like Rabbi Kelman said at the beginning, everybody has their own Rambam, but that shows his greatness. And he's even become something of a folk figure. And if you go into the Shuk in Jerusalem, here he is painted on one of the shutters. You can buy Rambam drink. You can buy the spices of the Rambam, right? Things that he may or may not have liked. You can buy Rambam holy water, which he definitely would not have liked, but he has become even larger than he was in life. And the picture in the middle is a drawing of the menorah that he put in. It's interesting because it's different than the way we usually think of the menorah, right? This V shape. And this is the way Chabad draws the menorah because of the Rambam. But it's just because we happen to have a lot, like I said, of his manuscripts, of his writings, and that's also a fascinating thing. So let us see. We have fewer questions this time. Why I spoke too fast? I don't know. Let's find out. Okay. I visited the Rambam house in Fez. There's no evidence. Yeah, of course. Well, we don't know if he lived there. But you should not go to the Maimon restaurant. Okay, thank you. We will not. His clinic in Alexandria is still there. Really? That's very cool. I did not know that. That's a very neat thing. Yes, he was in Alexandria for a short time, and then he moved on to Cairo. Okay, just told my friend who has connections with the Rambam Hospital, he would get a job. Wait time, bet he would be the head of the hospital, of course. Mishnah Torah is not a second Torah, but the teaching thereof. Okay, either way, right? And we also call Sefer Dvarim the Mishnah Torah. It's a little bit of a hubristic title. What is the name of the Rambam drink? I don't know. In the Shuk, it's called Mashkeh HaRambam. I don't know if it has a different name. There is a minhag to fast on Erev Parshat Shabbat Parshat Chukat to remember the burning of the Talmud. Thank you. It's terrible what was done to his grave. Yes, it's completely divided, but that's all the graves in Israel. Given how divisive the Rambam was in his time, how did he become so acclaimed? Because he's one of the greats. Ultimately, everyone recognizes the greatness of the Mishnah Torah. Maybe Rabbi Kelman wants to expand on that. I do not know. But even if they disagree with certain things, you cannot take away from the greatness of what he wrote. That's all I got to say.
There's a lot to expand, I guess. The Rambam, you can need like 5 years to discuss the Rambam. But I will say basically what happened is they ignored his philosophical works. The people who don't want to, who reads the Mor Nevuchim today? What yeshiva studies the Mor Nevuchim? And the first four chapters of Yesodei HaTorah, we talked about metaphysics and that the Gemara Abayin Rav is a small thing. A big thing is a study of metaphysics, you know. Divrei, you know, Gemara, that's like, all right, you know. So I think that's one of the things, but there is a lot more to say. But the Rambam was the greatest of the great. It's unbelievable. Like Shuli, you know, touched the surface, how one person can do so much is beyond belief. And there, I don't know how many tens or hundreds of PhDs are written a year on the Rambam. It's never ending, the study of the Rambam. So thank you really for a wonderful more than an overview, but a discussion of the Rambam, putting him in context. Those who want to come, please God, all should be well on our trips, our trip to Morocco. We will see that place in Fez where the Rambam, said, yeah, our trip in January to Morocco, January the 3rd, 2020.
Don't eat at the restaurant.
Yeah, we don't eat in the restaurant. please God, our first trip in 2 years, of course. And then this summer, we're planning a trip, as we mentioned last week, to Spain. And you'll see the statue in Cordoba. And you'll see more about the Rambam. So those who are thinking and want to travel, and please God, we should be healthy. Of course, only vaccinated people, obviously. Anyways, just to put that in. Tonight, Rabbi Gedalia Berger, who teaches in the GPATCH program, the Yotzot Halakha program, will be giving our Parsha about Yaakov's covert career. And tomorrow morning, I'll be giving my shiur 9:30 on the Seder. We're up to Birchat HaShachar. We're in our seventh week, and we just started on the Tenesach Vivin Alach Vivin Yom Laila last week. So we'll do Birchat HaShachar tomorrow, hopefully. I don't know if we'll finish it, but whatever, tomorrow morning. And then next week, our regular schedule. But next week, we start Rabbi Aaron Adler will be starting a three-part series Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Rav on Hanukkah. He did the Rav on Rosh Hashanah this year, and then the Rav on Pesach, the Rav on Yom Kippur, who was, of course, the shamus of the Rav in the 1970s. And he just came out with a book. Koren just published his book on 70 conversations with Rav Soloveitchik. So he'll be talking a three-part series Tuesday at 1 p.m. And we'll send up, hopefully later on today or before Shabbos, send out to register for that beginning on Tuesday. Okay, and then all our regular classes for those who are still here. Okay, nice to see everybody, and we look forward to learning with you, and we look forward to you inviting your friends to come and join with us. Like I say, invite one friend. Don't invite more. You need my permission, Baltosi, to invite more than one friend to come. But if everybody invites one friend to come to a class, we'll double our spreading of Torah. So, Vakasha, everybody, be well. And Shuli, please God, we'll see you next week. And okay, we'll speak in between.
Okay. Shabbat shalom, everyone.
Shabbat shalom.
Okay. Shabbat shalom, Yisrael.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
And thank you.
Thank you.